Welcome to Beat Infertility, a podcast where we get real about infertility, empower you to take back control, and provide you with hope for the future. Ready? Here's your host, fellow infertility warrior, Heather Hooman.
Welcome to episode 225. Today you'll hear the success story of a woman named Amy. She's a 38-year-old business owner who enjoys reading, exercising, and spending time with her friends and family. After 6 years of secondary infertility and trying all the things, Amy and her husband embraced the journey of foster care. They finally came to a place where they were okay with the idea of having one child and loving other children, whether they stayed or not. 3 years later, she's now raising 4 kids. After 1 year of fostering their now adopted son, she became pregnant spontaneously. You know how everyone says to just stop trying and it will happen, and it's the most annoying thing in the world? Yep, that's part of Amy's story. Her daughter was born in December 2018, and her son was officially adopted in September 2019 after 828 days in foster care. This past December, they welcomed another foster placement. Let's us know how Amy's gone from one child to four in what feels like the blink of an eye, and what she's learned along the way. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Heather. Thanks so much for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
Why don't we start by telling listeners a little bit about you? How old are you? What do you do for a living? And what do you do for fun?
Well, I'm almost 39. A couple of weeks, I'll be 39. I'm at that age where I can never quite remember how old I am. But anyways, I'm almost 39. I live in Melbourne, Florida. I run a business from home and fun. I love to exercise a bit. I'd say exercise is kind of my self-care. And for fun, I just love getting together with friends. I'm, you know, at this stage of life where it's harder, it gets harder and harder to do that. So, and you know, kind of girl, most of my friends don't, my closest friends, you know, live all over the country. And so I love getting to travel and see them is probably like the most fun thing I can do. But right now in the midst of the coronavirus, that's limited. So just trying to get fun wherever I can right now.
Think about your life before infertility. Back then, how would you describe yourself as a person?
I would say I was really hopeful. I thought my dream at that stage, I was an executive assistant. I never had huge career ambitions for myself. And really just my dream was to, you know, have a bunch of kids and be a stay-at-home mom. And so I guess I was very like maternal and nurturing. I like loved hosting parties, definitely very nurturing, you know, loved a lot in my relationships, but was always having parties and hosting baby showers and doing stuff for other people. I definitely was really hopeful and excited about motherhood.
Tell me about the first time you met your husband.
We met, I was in my late 20s and after college, I moved to the DC area and then I moved to Nashville. And so actually, it's funny because I moved to Nashville and was living with a friend. In that first night that I moved in, she was going to a friend's house to watch 24, and it was his house. He hosted these, you know, groups of people to watch 24. And so I didn't go that night, but I could have gone that night. But I met him, you know, later, and a few weeks later, I started going to these 24 watching parties. But so we are, our worlds overlapped. You know, he knew the friend that I had moved in with. He knew my co-workers. I was working for a small nonprofit. And then we started going to the same church. And so we just got to know each other right off the bat when I moved to Nashville.
Today, how would you describe you and your husband as a couple?
We are definitely a team. We are both self-employed. You know, now we are raising 4 kids and we definitely are a team. We're best friends. We should get more time together, just the two of us. But we dream a lot together. We both have a strong, which I think in the, drew us together even in the beginning. Like we dream and a lot together. We like creating things together. We love like brainstorming business ideas together. So he's just my best friend and my partner.
Was there a specific moment in your life when you first wanted to be a mom?
I honestly, I can't remember not wanting to be a mom. Like, I was the kid that always was babysitting. You know, I was like a mother's helper. Like, before I was even old enough to be a babysitter, I would go and play with, like, in our neighborhood. Like, I would ride my bike to, like, now I'm like, I need one of these in my life. But I would ride to, like, the, like, moms that had little kids. And, like, maybe they'd give me, like, $2 or $5. Maybe they, honestly, I don't even think half the time they gave me money. Like, they would take me to the playground with them. And I'd, like, play with their kids. Or I would just, like, go and, like, play Barbies with, you know, like, their toddlers. And, like, it was fun for me. So I always did that. And then I babysat, you know, as long as I can remember. And my first job was, you know, working at the YMCA, like, in, like, the childcare section. And then I always, in college, like, I worked with youth, and I worked at the Girls and Boys Club. Like, I just always was doing stuff with kids. So that was always in the cards for me.
How did longing to be a mom impact big decisions in your life?
Oh, definitely. You know, for me, it's funny looking back on it. Like, I, you know, I didn't have these huge aspirations for a career. I worked and was good at my job, but I didn't, it wasn't like I was like, I'm going to be a CEO and I'm going to conquer the world. Like, I just, I didn't think that way. I thought, like, all I wanted to do was be a, and then I don't mean to say that, like, all I want to do, but, like, that was what I wanted. Even in my career, so I was an executive assistant, and I kind of got to the, it, you know, for a large corporation, I kind of got to, like, the highest pay grade at that. And then it's like, okay, well, do I start climbing the corporate ladder? And for me, it was kind of like, well, I don't want to be traveling all the time. I didn't know a lot of women who were the kind of mom I wanted to be and who were successful professionally or had, you know, had a career, you know, that, that they loved and enjoyed. And so anyway, so I think for me, that was a huge part of it. Like, just in my dreams for my life, that was just not part of it. So, and then, you know, when we had our first child, like, definitely, you know, the steps that I took in my career, definitely thinking of having more kids was a huge part of it as well. I guess I would say even my college major, like, you know, I started majoring in nutrition and then I changed and did nonprofit management, just thinking, yeah, I just didn't, you know, as I think in retrospect, I'm like, man, I wish I'd majored in marketing, you know, now, you know, 20 years later, you just know yourself so much better and you have an idea of, like, what's possible. And I even think in motherhood, it's all hypothetical until you really get there in terms of what it looks like and how you thrive. And I definitely, motherhood was always part of everything and how I, my dreams for my life and my plans and all the decisions that I made.
Let's dive into the journey to build your family. Take us through your whole infertility timeline, starting at the beginning.
So I'm so bad at years and dates. So I got to think my son Bowman was born in March of 2011. So before that, so my husband and I were married in 2008. Shortly, we had planned, like, okay, 5 years and we're going to have 5 years. He's 11 years older than me. So he had been single for a really long time. I mean, at that time, he felt like he'd been single for a long time. But so we wanted to have 5 years to just be married. And but at the same time, we were completely open to having kids. If it happened. Then our first pregnancy, you know, it was, gosh, I guess it's sometime in 2010. And we, you know, weren't trying, but it just happened. And we were so excited. And then, you know, once that excitement came, we were like, okay, we definitely want to do this. That pregnancy ended in a miscarriage very early. It was like 6 or 7 weeks. You know, they just said it's kind of just medical, just the odds. You know, they couldn't identify any specific reason why I miscarried. And as soon as I could try again, I tried again, got pregnant again. Same thing happened. Miscarriage at 6 or 7 weeks. And then, you know, as soon as I could try again, I got pregnant. And then that was Bowman, our son Bowman. So again, they had no medical reason why those two miscarriages happened. I didn't do any kind of intervention between Bowman, but it was pretty quick. You know, as soon as I, like, it happened pretty quickly. So then we had Bowman in 2011. I went back and I worked full-time. Or when he was about 1.5, I started transitioning, to be a stay-at-home mom, you know, thinking, okay, you know, we're going to start trying for a second child and it's just going to happen. All my friends at that time were getting pregnant. You know, most of my good friends had 3 or 4 kids in a very short time frame, probably closer than they wanted to. And so for me, you know, I just kind of thought, oh, that's going to happen. So 2011 was when he was born. So that was around 2012. Transitioned to be a stay-at-home mom, and it wasn't happening. Like, it just, you know, I wasn't getting pregnant. I guess probably with about a year into trying for a second child, I started taking, you know, through my OB, I did, I think, 3 rounds of Clomid. And I'll say it was a big practice, and they kind of did not do, in retrospect, I'm like, they should not have been doing it, because they like, you know, you tried to get in for the ultrasound and you couldn't get in to see the right person. And then it was like the nurses didn't know what they were doing. And I'd be like, no, I need to get in. And they'd be like, oh, how about 2 weeks from now? You're like, no, that's not how this works. Anyways, but every time with the Clomid, they'd be like, oh, you've got 4 follicles. Like, you might have twins, get prepared. And it always seemed like my body was responding, but you know, it never happened. I never got pregnant. So I did that like maybe three rounds with them, but it was just a hot mess. It was stressful because it was an OB practice. It wasn't a fertility clinic. And so then I finally went to a fertility clinic and did, my husband had a really great health insurance at the time. And so we decided that, you know, we would just exhaust that in terms of resources. And I, since I had been pregnant before, you know, we opted for just doing IUI because I thought, you know, I'm like, it's happened once, it like should be able to happen again. So I did 3 rounds of IUI there that summer. And so then, you know, at the home, I think Spelman was probably 3 at that time. And each time it's like, you got 2 or 3 follicles. It looks so good. Like, man, maybe it'll be triple. Like, it's just every time they were like, it looks like really good. And then it would just never happen. So, you know, Bowman was 3 and full of energy and full of life. And, you know, all my friends were having baby. I think most of my friends by that time were probably on their 4th baby. And I will say I did have a few good friends who were going through the infertility journey, which was such a blessing because, you know, it's just such a unique world and it's so emotional. And just having people that you could talk to about it and, you know, friends that would like watch him while I would go to the appointments. Cause it's so time consuming and emotional and all of that. Anyways, did the rounds of that, nothing ever happened. And I was just emotionally exhausted by that point. I guess it'd probably been about 2 years altogether. And we were moving, we moved from the DC area to Florida. So I just kind of took a little break and just like moved to Florida, which is where we live now, you know, saw an OB here. I think I did, when we first came, I think I did do like 3, at least 2 or 3 rounds of Clomid here. And at that point, I was just so tired of it. And then I did kind of my last thing that I tried was I did like 3 months of acupuncture. I would say I was very skeptical, but I had several friends who were like, it really worked. And I did enjoy the process. But I think for me, the taking all the herbs, because you have to take the stuff in the morning and at night, it was just adding extra stress. And I mean, I liked going, but it just, you know, it didn't work. I didn't have a baby. And so through that process, I think we'd always kind of thought about adoption. But for me emotionally, like my husband is an only child. I never thought that I would have just one child. It just, you know, as I thought about my plans for motherhood and my life, like it was never just one kid, and it was always multiple kids. And so, and then all my friends were having all these kids. And so I just went through a lot of soul searching of like, you know, what am I supposed to be doing? And I was a stay-at-home mom. I was running a business from home. Being available with my time and my energy for my family was my primary objective. And so it's like, I felt like I had capacity to give and time and energy and just kind of thinking like, what am I supposed to do with this? And so, you know, I have a strong faith that guides and directs the way I live my life and my decisions. And so I did a lot of praying and soul searching about, you know, like, God, what are you asking of me? What's this all about? And I just began to sense more and more peace and just the ability to let go of my plan and my vision. The more I did that, like I always tell people, I think people, you always get this advice, like, just stop wanting it. Just, you know, just relax and don't be so stressed out. And it's like, that's so impossible because you just want it so badly. It's not like you can just turn it off. Like it's a switch of like, just turn off your deepest darkest or your deepest longing and desire, just, you know, like it doesn't happen. But I think if I just let go of my plans, became more open to this idea of foster care. And I think for me, the big thing was, because my husband and I did go kind of early on when we moved to Florida, even probably while I was still doing kind of maybe acupuncture, we went to a info session, and my husband was definitely not there yet, ready to do foster care. We also went to an info session about adoption. Honestly, we both thought that's what we were supposed to do, but we went and we just were like, we didn't feel peace about it. And then the foster care thing kept coming up. So anyways, as I just really kind of stepped in, for me, the flip that switched was just being able to see and begin to have dreams for our life as a unit of three, of just, you know, our son Bowman and me and my husband, and be able to like start seeing the beauty of that. And yeah, just really like seeing all the benefits of just having one child and being able to have dreams and then being able to say, you know, like we have capacity and love to give, and whatever children enter our family, we know we can love them and care for them. And, you know, yes, our desire was to adopt, but being able to like have a dream for our family that if we don't, that's not like, we're not going to be crushed if we don't get to, because the point is loving them and just being open to what like the future would hold for our family, and just being really excited for where we were. And so then we began to be foster parents, and which is a long process. So it was like July 2014. We were both like, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to be foster parents. But then it wasn't even until that next January that we really started the process. And then by April, we were certified. We got our first call within like a couple days. But that was really short. It was like 12 hours. And then a couple weeks later, we got a call for an infant from the hospital. And that was our plan, was just to take 0 to 2 years old kids. And we like thought we wanted a baby. And then we got this baby and we were like, whoa, this is really hard. Because like having an infant, we knew when we got him that he was only going to be there for a few weeks, because of his case, that they like there was family members that were going to take him. They just had to go through some background checks and all that. So it was about 3 weeks. You know, he came from the hospital, was with us, and that was, you know, not getting any sleep, and that's like the hardest time. And with just everything else, we're like, okay, maybe we're open to older kids. So I think we raised it to 4 at that point, and then we had one little girl come for a couple weeks. We fell in love with, which was just this huge heartbreak. And she left after a few weeks. And then, but then we got this call for our son, Frank. He's just this adorable, adorable little 2-year-old boy. And it's crazy because if you see a picture of our family, like he looks just like us. Not that that matters at all. It doesn't matter. We would love him even if he didn't, but it's just people get a kick out of that, how much he looks, looks like us. So anyway, so Frankie came. And we were still really heartbroken over that loss of this little girl who we were hoping we were going to get to adopt. And so Frank's story was a long road. It was 838 days in foster care before we actually adopted him. And we didn't know, you know, so with foster care, the parents get a year to try and reunify. But so I can't really go into all the details of his story, but I can just say like, it was really unknown. We went to trial. Like it was extremely emotional and you just have no idea what's going to happen. But so he, about a year and a half into having Frankie, and we were just totally in love with him, we actually had another older girl come to our family for a few months, and she was 9 years old. And so there was a lot of things. We hadn't planned to take anyone older than our son Bowman. And so there were definitely some complications with that. I remember I texted my husband and I was like, you know, I don't feel like Tyla, and she's part of a sibling group. So they were trying to get her back with them. I don't think she's, you know, supposed to, like, I feel peace with her leaving, but there's something about three, like there's something about this dynamic of the three kids that, you know, like really feels right. And she left, and like literally a week later, I found out that I was pregnant. And I'll tell you, it's having gone through this journey, you know, like they tell you, people are like, I just stopped trying. This was probably 3 years of me not tracking, not taking my temperature, not counting my days, But still, I think this was really the first month where I literally could not remember when my period was. Like, my husband and I were like trying to guess. Like, I was like, because always, you're just always paying attention to it. Even if you're not trying, like, you know, how many times you're like, oh man, I think I'm late. And you run out and get a test and then it's negative. This time it was like, I remember telling Mark a couple weeks before, and I was like, you know, I'm like, I think Aunt Flo's coming. And then it was like 2 weeks later, I was like, wait, Aunt Flo never came. And I like was so, I was terribly sick. I had the flu and my son had a flu, but it hit me like so much harder and something was wrong with me. And then I was like, I just had this thought and I'm like, I need to get a test. But normally I would think I have this test and I'd go through all these thoughts and all these imaginations. You know, it was like, it'd become this huge thing and there'd be this disappointment. But this, it was just so different. It was really the first time. It took me like so many years to get there. And so I just laugh because people are like, just stop trying. And, you know, people want to summarize my story of like, well, just become a foster parent and just stop trying and then it's going to happen. But it's like, literally that was like 6 years in the making of getting to that point emotionally. And so, yeah, so we got pregnant and with a baby girl. Her name is Libby, and she is now at this moment 15 months. But so when she was 3 weeks old is when we went to trial for Frank. So that was like so crazy stressful because we had, I mean, really no idea until going into his trial last January. So it's January of 2019, what was going to happen and what the judge was going to decide. And it totally could have gone either way. And I'm like nursing her outside the door and of the courtroom, you know, the whole time. And then, so that was January, was his court, the trial, but then there's also an appeal process. So it wasn't until September, this last September, that we actually adopted him. So this last September, we adopted Frankie. He is now just turned 5. So Bowman just turned 9. Frankie just turned 5. And then Libby is 15 months. And then this last December, which is crazy, I had just started launching a new business. And it was December 9th. And we built a house for my husband's parents are older. His dad has dementia and is 87 and is on hospice care at the moment. When he moved in with us a year, he wasn't on hospice care yet. But this last December, he was in the hospital for like 2 months, came back with hospice. I guess he was still in the hospital when we got a phone call for this little girl. For there's like a 5-year-old girl. And we honestly hadn't gotten a phone call in so long. And we got a phone call a few weeks before for this 5-year-old nonverbal autistic child. We were like, we can't do that. Like, that's like, we just don't have the capacity to care for a child with that many needs. And then we got this call for, you know, a 5-year-old little girl. And it was right, you know, just early December for Christmas. And life was so crazy and so full. But we were just like, you know, we can do it. And because of our setup and our how we built this house with the in-law suite for my in-laws. So it's basically like a independent apartment attached to our home. And my mother-in-law is really his full-time caretaker. And we just have tried to, by moving with us, we've simplified her life. So she has a lot less to take care of so she can focus on caring for him. Anyways, the kids' bedrooms are not that big. The boys share a room because when we started building this house, we didn't know we were pregnant. So it had like two, it's a Jack and Jill basically rooms that are not very big. Like really, they're not big enough for two beds, like for two twin beds. It's the boys have bunk beds. And then, but because of the situation, we could only accept a girl because Libby's room has a crib in it. So we knew we had like a crib and a queen size bed. And it was kind of also the guest room. And there's no other room in the room besides that. Bed was the changing table. Everything else was in the closet. Not a huge room, but we knew, you know, just going through this process, I think especially, you know, when you've just asked and prayed for babies for so long and then you get this phone call and we're like, yes. Okay. Yes. So now I have 4 kids. We have no idea what is going to happen with our foster daughter. She will be with us for a while. We don't know what happens after that, but it's, you know, it's just crazy. So for so many years I had one and felt like I had just so much to give, felt like my hands were so empty. And now I'm completely the opposite. I'm like, they're so full. And so our foster daughter is almost 6. So she's 6 and Frank's 5. And then we have the baby is like in, I call this suicide watch phase, you know, where they're just like into everything and mobile and moving. And I am tired. And I am like full deep into motherhood right now. It's just funny because I feel like, especially even with Libby, having gone through the journey that we've gone through, like it just makes you appreciate it so much more. And it's like, yes, it's tiring. Yes, it's exhausting. But you just, I feel like it has just given me so much more joy. I feel like we just enjoy everything so much more. And even our son Bowman, like he prayed for siblings for so long. And it still amazes us because he was an only child for so long and he had our one-on-one attention. And yes, he occasionally gets annoyed that these little kids are, you know, in his stuff, but he loves his baby sister so much. He loves his little brother so much. I think it's seeing, going through this process, like it's been a journey for him too. And the Frank and our foster daughter, like they just love this baby so much. And it's so crazy because I just think like she has been such a gift to everyone. Not just, you know, we longed for a baby so long, but that they, you know, they love having a baby sister so much. So that is the journey of the last few years. I'm sure I left some details out, but it has been a wild road.
I actually want to go back to the early part of your journey first, and then we'll work our way to motherhood. When you were trying to conceive on your own initially, what was the first sign that you might want to consult a medical professional?
Honestly, so, you know, we had the two miscarriages, and I did go to the doctor for those, and I was young. I mean, I was in my early 28, but I didn't get any help. And then I think it was probably just my friends, you know, most of my friends went to the same OB. And so, you know, had been on Clomid or, you know, her, I tried it. So I think just talking to friends of like hearing their story, I think other people sharing was really hugely helpful to me. Cause you know, I just had no idea what to do. And having a practice that I really liked, you know, I'd had Bowman there. And, you know, I really respected the doctor. But then I think a lot of my friends were moving to this fertility clinic and then hearing about their experience and then just dealing with these frustrations. I think, you know, you don't know what you don't know until you get there. But, you know, for me, that especially that switch to the fertility clinic, like I kind of wish I'd gone to the fertility clinic right away because everyone needs to know what's going on. Like the people that answer the phone and schedule the appointments need to understand how important it is that you're there on certain days and just to be, you know, operating with that in mind. You know, when I was trying to just do it with my OB, especially because it was a big practice, I think it's a little different if you are with a small practice. And like, I just think about my experience with having Bowman here locally. It was a small OB practice of just one doctor, but his nurses like know everything. The fronts, the receptionist, our office manager like knows everything, knows all the people and knows all the stories. And so I could see that being different, but especially being at that big practice where they just were fielding so many phone calls and it was kind of like a baby factory, even though they did great at caring for us through having Bowman, it was not set up for fertility. So I do kind of wish in retrospect, I mean, I don't know that would change anything, but that is what I would tell other people is that if you are struggling and you need help, I would say, because it is so stressful, that to go to seek the advice of a fertility specialist, because they just have, you know, that's just what they do. And they have so much better information. And it is so frustrating when you have to do the same thing over and over. I definitely would recommend that. But I think having friends sharing their story was really helpful in guiding those first decisions.
Hey, Infertility Warrior, it's Heather. This episode of Beat Infertility is brought to you by me. Regular listeners of the show know that I struggled during my infertility journey with everything from finding the right clinic to advocating for a protocol customized to my body, to allowing infertility to consume my entire existence and everything in between. In other words, I've been where you are. Now that I'm on the other side and have interviewed hundreds of other warriors and fertility experts, I've discovered the fastest way to realize your dream of becoming a parent is to get educated, regain hope, build resiliency, learn self-advocacy skills, and partner with someone who's been there. Whether you're an infertility newbie or a seasoned veteran, it would be my honor and privilege to provide, as one client put it, unwavering support with fully engulfing and genuine empathy. If you'd like to learn more or schedule a free 30-minute call to discuss how I can support you during your infertility journey, go to beatinfertility.co/hope. Now, back to the show. You never received an official diagnosis, correct?
Correct. I finally, before we moved, I had went to one last doctor. It was kind of like I'd done the fertility thing, the big fertility clinic, and they weren't successful. And so a friend had recommended a small OB practice where it was just very intimate and you got a lot of personalized attention. And he was like, maybe you just can't get pregnant. Because I kept thinking, my thought was like, well, I know I can do this. Like I did it. It happened one time. And, you know, it's already happened. Because the thing that was crazy is between Bowman and Libby, I only had one pregnancy. I did have one miscarriage between the two of them. But through all that time, there wasn't any others. So he thought, he was like, maybe it was just, he was just a miracle. And that was really hard because I was like, all these other doctors were like, you're fine. But I never got a diagnosis. All my blood work always came back fine. And they were like, so that's the frustrating thing is they all run the same tests and they never could identify anything. So, and I think that was in some ways even more frustrating. I mean, I don't know what it's like to have a diagnosis, but for me, because I'm like, I don't know why there's no explanation. There's nothing I can do that to fix this. And especially because I would get so hopeful because they'd be like, oh, it looks so good. And your follicles are long or they're responding. And then it just wouldn't happen. So
why did you choose to foster and how did you reconcile that the children might not permanently stay with you?
It was a process for sure. It was just that emotional journey. I had to get to a place where I liked our life, like seeing the good of what we did have and just like loving. For me, I think the big point part was like having dreams because, you know, it was funny because then once I got pregnant with Libby, and then, because I got pregnant with Libby before we knew Frank was staying. So I got pregnant and then I was like, man, everything shifted in my head. Like, I was like, wait, like I had all these dreams and plans because we're like, okay, Bowman is, you know, older. We can start going on trips and we could go, you know, take him to New York City and, you know, do all these things that you can do when you only have one kid and he's already older as opposed to like, okay, well now we have a toddler. It was funny because then I had to go through that shift of like, oh wait, this is back to those dreams in the beginning. And there was a little bit of a loss because I had gotten excited about where we were. So I think for me, that was a big part of it, like being able to be excited for where we were and to let go of kind of my plans for how things were supposed to be and or like what I'd always imagined them being. And I think also a big part for me was in this part, you know, you don't know, like if Frank had gone back, I hoped that and I did invest in his relationship with his mom. So with hopes that she would keep us in his life. So that was a big hope for me that, you know, even if a child goes back, that we would, you know, they'd be part of our life and being able to kind of let go of, you know, whether or not he gets our last name, you know, he'll always be kind of one of my babies, you know, and then I'll be able to love him. And I did have a lot of, or at least several family friends growing up who had kids like that in their lives that they hadn't maybe formally adopted, but that they were really a part of their family. So I did have that kind of model in mind and that really definitely helps me. But like, you know, with our foster daughter right now, like we still don't know what's going to happen with her. And so like, I hope that, you know, long-term will be part of our life. And I will say like, this is a very different experience with her and even for our kids, because, you know, first time around, especially with Frank, like we did want to adopt him so badly. And now it's kind of like, whoa, we've got three kids, like four kids. This is a big transition. It's different because it's not about us. Not that it was about us in the beginning, but that was always kind of there. You know, you always kind of still hoped it. So I think it's a process, but I think so much of it is just the need and you realize being able to look at it, it's not about me getting what I want, but like I have these resources. I have this love, I have the time, I have the space, and how can I use that to help other people and not about me just getting what I want? And I'll tell you, that's still messy because still, you know, there were many days where I'm like, I just want to adopt him, and I would be stressed out. And so it's one thing to say it. It's one thing to really be there, and you go back and forth all the time. It's, you know, no one has it perfect. But also I think for me, another differentiator was the fact that we had Bowman. We wanted him to have the character attributes of sharing, of not being an only child. My husband, especially having been an only child, he did not want that for our son. We saw that foster care could be a way for him to, you know, have to share and have to, you know, love kids and, you know, think about things that are like more than just himself. And so that was like a big draw too, part, you know, kind of part of the conversation is like, this will be good for him. And it has been absolutely, like, he, you know, it's stuff like, even we've had, with our current placement, there's definitely some hards to it, and it's been hard for the kids. It's cost them something. It's cost them something, but even still, like, and Bowman will say, he'll say, Frank was so much easier than she is. Like, Frank was just so easy for him to love and accept. And like, from the get-go, like, they were just best buddies. But if I ask him, like, do you want to keep fostering? He's like, absolutely, yes. He was a big part of that. And I would say for my husband too, that was a big thing for him, because he's like, you know, and I think a lot of parents think, he was one of the reasons why we didn't want to do it at first, because we thought, like, this will be too much for him, like too much loss. But like, we had friends that had done it, and they said like their kids just loved it, and that they're in the, and kind of the same thing. They said, you know, every time a child leaves, we ask them, you know, do you want to keep doing this? And they would say like, absolutely. And so that really helped us. And I think kids, it's different, because as parents, we think, you know, when a kid goes back, there's not just the, you know, I love this child and I miss them, but you also, there's so much fear because you know, like, what they're going back into. And but kids don't have that fear because they don't know and they don't understand like what it means. Like, I remember like with Frank, like several times Bowman, you know, met his parents and his bio parents, and they don't seem like bad people to me. And not that we ever said they were bad people, but to his little mind, you know, he's trying to understand it all. Like, he just thought they were nice, you know? So, I think for us, that was a transition of like, instead of being afraid of how it would affect him, it's like being able to see like, this actually could be really good for him. And it 100% has proven to be the case.
What role did infertility play in your business?
It's funny, because like I said in the beginning, like, I never had these ambitions of like running a business or being a CEO or, you know, having big goals for myself. But well, first of all, like I said, motherhood is so hypothetical until you get there, and you have no idea what it's going to feel like, or, you know, how you and your spouse are going to work together or any of that until you're there. And when I was home with my son, like, I realized like, I just really missed working, and then going through the infertility stuff, it's just so defeating. So I built a business from home, and I think so much of it was just self-care for me, you know, just being able to have something that you can control. And not that I can be fully in control of my business, but, you know, each time, like, I just needed those little, like, every time I got a new customer or, you know, my business grew, like, it was just so good for me. And I say, you know, so many times, like, I just wish God had given me back then, like, I'd much rather have taken a baby than a business. But, you know, that wasn't God's plan. And I think there were a lot of lessons that I learned through my business that really helped me, you know, that I have learned through my business that have, you know, that helped equip me to do foster care too. Like, I just, you know, faced a lot of fears. And I think part of it is just really stepping into your journey of like, sometimes there's that fear of like, you know, my life is supposed to be this way. And instead of just really authentically embracing where you are and what you're feeling, and that it was all kind of wrapped together. And I think I now, like, being at this place where I am today, you know, 4 kids, and I feel like I don't have a minute to myself. Like, I have such a better understanding of myself now and what I need to do to be there for these kids in terms of, like, I know that I love to work and it's an important part of who I am, and making time to build my business is a good and positive thing for me and for my family. Whereas if I had, you know, been at this place early on, like I probably wouldn't have understood that about myself and I wouldn't have made the time for it. And I wouldn't have seen the growth and the fruit, you know, both financially as well as, you know, in my character and my leadership skills and all the things. So it's been such a blessing, honestly. I think, honestly, infertility just changes you. Like, it changes you in so many ways. You know, none of us get to choose what's going to grow us as people. I mean, I think we all have challenges for a reason. You know, how we respond to them says so much about our character and how we grow into the people that we're supposed to be. I wouldn't pick infertility for anyone, but I wouldn't pick any, you know, I wouldn't pick cancer or loss or whatever it might be, whatever challenges, you know, someone might face, but it's 100% has changed me into being, you know, a more compassionate, authentic, genuine person. And for that, I'm so thankful.
I know you wanted to share some tips for time blocking and lightening the mental load of motherhood. So why don't you do that?
I guess I would say, especially, you know, it's funny because we scheduled this several months ago and now we are right in the middle of the coronavirus craziness. So I find myself at home with four kids and I think especially it, whatever you're going through. So, you know, if many women are listening to this and they're, you know, deep in the infertility journey, you know, I would just encourage you to make time for things that are going to fill your tank. Emotionally, for people that are going to fill your tank. And so one of the things that I love about time blocking is it, enables you to really live intentionally and to look at your day and choose your priorities, especially I think when you have something so time consuming, like infertility treatments are, you know, it just can be so taxing, but it, putting limits on it in terms of like what it's going to take over your, what of your day it's going to take over as opposed to like letting it kind of rule your life, because it can totally rule your life and then just be this thing that you constantly obsess over. But instead, you know, look at your day and build in things like, you know, exercise or meditation or reading or time with a friend or watching a funny show or, you know, work that fulfills and challenges you. Whatever that looks like. So time blocking is a practice that has meant the world to me. And I, how I do it is I use really just my Google Calendar and I schedule in everything. And I will say I am super ADD and all over the place. So I do not 100% stick to my time blocking schedule, but just the practice of doing it is takes this mental load off because you know when things are, you know, supposed to happen. And it helps me, I always just say it's about progress over perfection. Intentionality is not the same thing as perfection. I have it all set up on my Apple Watch. So I have, like today, I just looking at my Apple Watch and it says 10:30 to 12:30 declutter project. So I try to like once a week, I try to block out a couple of hours. And, you know, now, of course, everything has changed with coronavirus. But, you know, putting those things on so you have those reminders. And honestly, too, I think you can do that for self-care, for just emotional, like if there's a mantra or something that I imagine your listeners are all over the place in terms of their journeys, maybe they've been through infertility, but whatever those things that you need to remind yourself of, you know, you can set those up on there to just, you know, or like a reminder of like, I'm going to take 5 minutes to, you know, to think about, you know, what I'm thankful to practice gratitude today. But any of those just daily disciplines that you want to make part of your life, putting them on your calendar and setting those reminders, and they can pop up on your phone too, just to help you start living the way that you want to live. So the more I like, you know, it takes me those day by day reminders to help me to actually do them. That would be my tip to just start living more intentionally. If you are in any way interested in foster care, please message me. You can find me on social media at amymariehan.com. Also, I would tell you just to go to an info session. I think especially as we come through this coronavirus, that there's going to be a flood of kids entering the foster care system because there are so many kids stuck at home in not good situations. And thankfully, many school systems are offering food, but hopefully parents are getting out to take advantage of that. But I just think it's going to be bad. Go to an info session and just learn more. Going to an info session does not mean you're signing up. It just means you're getting your questions answered. That's what I would add.
It'll be interesting when people listen to this episode a year, 2 years from now, because I know a lot of new listeners start from the beginning and just sort of binge on the show.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting, you know, talking about all this coronavirus stuff. I definitely agree with you that there is probably going to be a flood. I know a lot of my connections in the adoption world have said that everything has been upended in terms of their process and the number of children who are needing to be adopted. So yeah, it's definitely going to get crazy. The one other thing that I wanted to just sort of ponder about, and maybe you have more information, is we obviously can't do any in-person training for foster care right now. My county, because my husband and I looked into this, my county requires 27 hours of training. And I just don't know how they are even doing that right now.
I've done all my training online. So they have a bunch of different trainings that you can do. I don't know if they have a system in place to do the full, because what they do here is it's 3 hour meetings for 12 weeks. So I don't know if they're going to do that. I mean, I think they're kind of just figuring it all out, but I hope so, because I definitely think there's going to be a huge need. And I think everyone, like you said, scrambling, trying to figure out this new normal. But I hope that they will figure that out.
You talked about this a little bit earlier, but how has infertility changed you?
Definitely way more authentic. I think I had, you know, this perception of who I was supposed to be. I think just like, I'm a high achieving person, and I just, you know, I wanted to be the mom who, like, I thought I was supposed to be the mom who was at every school event and, you know, had the Pinterest perfect mom. I think it just kind of peeled back the onion to both having this process of me building a business and like saying like, I actually really love this and I want to have both. And I actually don't want to be the Pinterest perfect mom. I just being able to be more authentic and real, I think it has helped me identify with pain a lot more. I think just being a lot more flexible in life and open to change. And just as I say that, I'm in the midst of this coronavirus and I'm like, I thought I learned that lesson, but apparently not, because, you know, it's just all of life. I think you just realize that it's all of life. And like I said before, I think in the beginning, I internalized it so much and just thought like, this is because I'm a bad mom. Like that was the fear. The fear voice was saying, you know, if I was a good mom, then I would be able to have more babies. And that must be why I can't have more babies. And I think for me, the biggest change was being able to recognize like, no, that is a lie. And I'm not going to listen to it. And I'm not going to let that stop me. And I know that I'm a good mom. And I know that there are kids that need love. And I am going to choose to show up and do that. It's changed me so much. And I think also it's a connection point for people that, and that's why I'm pretty open with my story. And it's amazing. Like I share a lot, like on social media about infertility and about foster care and kind of our journey, because I just know there are so many people suffering silently that are dealing with those thoughts and thinking, you know, it's because I'm a bad mom or it's because something's wrong with me or, you know, and they look at everyone else's, you know, social media perfection and think, you know, that everyone's just got it all together and they have these just huge unmet desires, but it's just not the case. And so it's amazing when I'll run into people and they'll be like, oh, I saw that thing you posted. And I like, honestly, it'll be like a neighbor that I hardly know, but they are those, you know, just sharing my story has meant so much to them. When you share your vulnerability and your struggles, you just realize there's so many other people dealing with it. And I feel like it's allowed me to get to know people a lot. People are much more vulnerable and open with me because of that. So, which is such a blessing, because I don't do surface level very well.
Knowing what you know now, what is one piece of advice that you give to your past self?
It's like, I wouldn't even say that it's all going to work out. It's just more like, enjoy the process. I wish I could have just enjoyed that season more with Bowman. And I do think I did, but I wish I could just be present and be where you are. Just be more present through the process and enjoy that season that I had and not be so wrapped up on what I don't have, because there were just so many blessings in that season of longing and anticipation, and I wish I had been more present.
To wrap up the episode, what words of hope would you offer to someone who's just beginning her infertility journey?
I would offer words of hope of like that this is a good process, that you are going to grow in that whatever. I think one of the things that is so hard that we all deal with in the beginning is just that big question is because people want to just say like, it's going to happen and you're going to get pregnant. I can't tell anyone what's going to happen and what's going to happen for their story. And it's not always a fairy tale ending, but I would just tell people to show up and to be honest with how they're feeling and to not try to pretend they're feeling something that they're not, and to find people that are going to love them and walk through them with this journey, because it is lonely, but you don't have to do it alone. And people that are going to encourage you and build you up every step of the way, and to just embrace this process, because you're going to learn, you're going to grow. There is a plan for you, but I don't know what it is. And just to be open to what that is, you know, to not hold so tightly to this vision of what you want. Like it's such a balancing act of having, of, you know, being honest with the vision you have for your life and the hopes that you have, and not pretending that you don't have them, but at the same time, just holding them loosely. And because I think the plans that you have, what's going to happen is far better than you can imagine. If you can just let go of it enough to just be open to what your story has. So that's what I found when I could just let go of, stop holding it so tightly and just open up my grasp and let go of my plan for my life, is when the plan got really good.
Amy, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story with us. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you so much, Heather.
Thank you for listening to Beat Infertility. Join our free private support community at beatinfertility.co/app. If you find yourself needing additional support, visit our paid programs at beatinfertility.co/hopeyou. If you'd like your story to be considered for a future episode, please fill out the form at beatinfertility.co/contact. Until next time.